Dr. Adrian Pine, a critical medical anthropologist who has worked in Honduras, Mexico, and Cuba, among others. She is also an author of her latest book, which is titled Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. Dr. Pine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know there are reports that children are being sexually abused and assaulted at the US border. How do you think this could affect their future as well as the future of the American society?
Well, first of all, unaccompanied children are unaccompanied in large part right now because the United States government is denying their parents the right to seek asylum, the internationally guaranteed right to seek asylum. And so their parents are doing the only thing they can to save their children, which is to send them alone from the border, where you've got a lot of families together hoping to cross together, but since only their children are the ones who are allowed, they're sending them in by themselves. And then they're being immediately detained in what was supposed to be a shift from the Trump administration's quote-unquote kids in cages policy to something more humane.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Pine.
Among the new arrivals, there are many children still too young to grasp what it is that's happening to them. Unaware of what is going on, the children, many of whom are not even accompanied by any adults, are kept in overcrowded cages at the border facilities.
There were complaints that were filed with state agencies, and those complaints articulated very specific allegations about sexual assault on minors at this Freeman Center.
Currently, we have no basis for his call to shut down the the San Antonio Freeman Coliseum as an intake site, but we will, of course, we take these allegations seriously, and they will be investigated.
It is one thing to report the suffering of children stuck at the border. It is another altogether to imagine the impact that the current situation would have on their future lives.
There are reports of sexual harassment of the kids, probably portraying only a glimpse of the reality of what is actually happening. But what is the root cause to the problem the U.S. is facing for decades? To have a better understanding of the situation, we've asked Dr. Aviva Chomsky to join us. She's a professor of history and the coordinator of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at the Salem State University. She's the author of The Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal. Welcome, Dr. Chomsky.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So, is there a plan in the Biden administration to tackle the issue through Washington's policies towards Central America?
Biden's plan for Central America follows that longstanding bipartisan consensus. It's a plan for security and prosperity in Central America. Now, those two words might sound good, but when you understand what they mean in the context of the United States and Central America, security means that the United States is going to continue to pour money into military and policing in Central America. Prosperity means that the United States is going to continue to impose upon Central America an economic model that's based on the privileging of foreign investment.
Currently, there is not enough space for children, and some facilities remain short on staff, at least according to some reports. Some kids are not eating enough food, and those infected with the coronavirus are not separated from the healthy ones. Texas has a dark history of abuse against migrant children. Sexual assaults and gang violence in Texas youth lockups was last brought to the spotlight in October 2020, when two justice and legal organizations sounded the alarm.
For more than a decade, the Texas Juvenile Justice Department has been associated with abuse of children and denying them their constitutional rights. So can we expect the situation to become better today?
Instead of ending the policy of kids in cages, as they named it, corporate Democrats and media, allied media alike, what we see is kids in quote-unquote overflow facilities that also are seeing human rights abuses, sexual abuses, children being deprived of their basic human rights, their basic hygienic needs, sunlight, showers. And so the media has quieted down. The corporate Democrats have quieted down. This really was more than anything a campaign issue to rile people up to vote for Biden, when in fact Biden is just as bad as Trump on the issue.
The recent spike in the number of new arrivals at the border has implications for both sides of the power play in the United States. After their loss in the 2020 presidential election, Republicans are resorting to any cards on the table in order to undermine the new Biden administration. The fate of children detained at the border is no different.
The Donna facility is a giant tent city. Built with a capacity of 250, it has nearly 4,000 people in it. We saw cages after cages after cages of little girls, of little boys, lying side by side, touching each other, covered with reflective emergency blankets. There was no 6-foot space, there was no 3-foot space, there wasn't a 3-inch space between the children lined up one after the other after the other.
Take Texas, which voted for former President Trump. With the new Democratic administration in the White House, Texas is locked in a battle with the federal government over the issue. Texas wants the kids out of the state to ensure safety, as Republican Governor Greg Abbott has said. The Texan conservatives would feel uncomfortable by the idea of open borders and an influx of refugees into the country, particularly as Trump had promised to solve the problem with a wall, which appears to have failed. But has anything really changed with President Biden in power?
Everybody has the right to request asylum, but that was the policy that Trump implemented. Now, when Biden became president, he said he was going to change that policy. Really, he's only changed one very small piece of it, which is that he's allowing unaccompanied minors who appear at the border to request asylum. Nobody else, not families with young children, nobody else. So he's only made one small change to the Trump policy, but there were many hundreds of children at the border who have been in squalid refugee camps on the street for weeks or months.
One of the key political figures at the center of the border crisis is Vice President Kamala Harris. Republican politicians and conservative-leaning media often target her as she has been tasked with stemming the migration.
I've asked her, the VP today, because she's the most qualified person to do it, to lead our efforts with Mexico and the Northern Triangle and the countries that help us. We're going to need help in stemming the movement of so many folks stemming the migration to our southern border.
Appointed as Biden's border point woman, Harris has still not visited the disaster zone, and that is the main argument brought up by Republicans. Roberta Jackson, President Biden's top official for border issues, is also stepping down after 100 days on the job. That has made the administration's task of handling the border crisis more challenging as criticism is mounting. So, Dr. Pine, how do you assess the administration's effort to address the issue so far?
Well, the reports we're hearing from lawyers who have toured these facilities, as they have a legal right to do, is that children are being kept sometimes for 8 days without having the right to take a shower. They're being held without going outside. They're not given the right to contact their parents or their family members. These are inhumane conditions. These are conditions that I and many others consider to be torture, and frankly, they need to end. There's no excuse for this to be going on, and the Biden administration is hanging on to this argument that at least we're better than Trump and we're trying to change things, but there are a lot of things that they could do right now.
The president has been trying to house the migrant children in other states that are away from the border. Yet his initiative has not been successful everywhere. In Iowa, for example, the request has been rejected, and Governor Kim Reynolds has called the border crisis the president's problem.
First of all, I think this is an opportunity for two parties to sit down at the table and find a compromise. This is ridiculous. It's what we've done here in Iowa. We have figured out how two parties can work together and put Iowans first and move the ball forward and get something done. So there's no reason that they can't do it as well. And it's just ridiculous. And I think not only Iowans, but the American people are sick and tired of it. And there's a pretty easy compromise right there.
Today, Reynolds asserts that her priority is the health and safety of Iowans, and that the state does not have enough facilities to house migrant children. Under former President Trump, Reynolds ironically accepted migrants into the states, along with more than 30 other state governors. Yet the issue of immigration is not exactly Trump's fault, and has its roots in decades of atrocities against Central America.
And this is not just Trump policies, once again. This goes back to, for example, the Biden policy for Central America, which was implemented following the unaccompanied minor crisis of 2014 and involved the sending millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to massive development projects and militarized security aid to the Northern Triangle countries, which increased the vulnerability, it increased the violence, and it increased the concentration of wealth among the wealthiest, the oligarchs.
U.S. policies toward migrants has also created a crisis for Mexico. Mexico's border cities are not equipped to house, feed, and protect tens of thousands of refugees. Many of the cases of migrants forced to remain in Mexico ended with deportation orders from judges because they failed to show up for the immigration court hearing on the U.S. side of the border.
Are you a little nervous this morning? See? Do you understand what these proceedings here in court are all about? Do you know what a lawyer is? Sophia, good morning. Are you a little nervous this morning? See? Do you have a lawyer?
They have had to stay in places such as the Mexican state of Tamaulipas, where rape, torture, and kidnapping are so pervasive that the U.S. State Department itself has a do not travel advisory on. Yet the real humanitarian crisis could be ongoing, not in Mexico or at the U.S. border, but away from media cameras in Central America.
Well, here in the United States, unfortunately, we tend to see the humanitarian crisis only in terms of what's happening at the border. That is a humanitarian crisis, but the real humanitarian crisis is what's happening in Central America. Changing our immigration and border policies could relieve some of the crisis that's happening on the border, but to really change the roots of the crisis and where the crisis, the heart of the crisis, would mean to change our policies towards Central America. Now, Central American countries and people in Central America have tried over and over and over again to create their own independent path to development. The problem is that the United States intervenes every single time to overthrow those attempts to seek a different development model.
Since President Biden appeared in office, he has canceled some of Trump's restrictions against migrants. He is gradually admitting asylum seekers who enrolled in a program snubbed by the former president. Under Trump, the migrants had to wait in Mexico until their cases were processed in the United States. The January 2019 policy, which was commonly known as the Remain in Mexico program, forced 71,000 migrants back into Mexico to file for asylum and wait for an indefinite amount of time.
It's quite dangerous because we're on the border, we're not from here, and danger is present all the time. So we put our hope in President Biden and everything he promised in his campaign. We hope he sticks to his promises.
For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. We are joined tonight by Jason Zubo. He's an immigration attorney, partner at Pilcher and Zubo PLLC, and a blogger at asylumist.com. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Let's jump right in. We want to discuss these latest sexual abuse allegations coming out of a child migration facility center in San Antonio, Texas, Where do these fit into the broader pattern of what's happening at the southern border?
Well, first, thank you for inviting me. You know, the latest allegations fit within the pattern that we've been seeing for years and years at the border. I mean, essentially, Governor Abbott said that there are sexual abuse of minor boys at a facility in Texas, and he's called upon that facility to be closed. You know, one issue that's sort of in the background of all this is the private prison industry, which basically incarcerates many of these immigrants who are coming to the United States and asking for political asylum. So these people are not criminals for the large majority, and they come here, they're seeking protection. Many of them are unaccompanied if they're children, and part of the reason for that is just the policy of allowing certain people into the United States who are unaccompanied minors, but if family units arrive or if adults arrive, they're immediately turned away under what's called 42, which is basically a rule that allows the federal government to turn away people at the border based on the public health emergency of coronavirus. So what you have is a situation of largely private prisons housing minors who often don't speak English, who don't know their rights, who are, of course, confused and scared, very vulnerable population. And so, you know, the governor's allegations, while they're not proven at all yet, do fit a pattern that we have seen, and there has been a problem with sexual abuse of immigrant detainees, not only at the border, but throughout the United States. It's really been an ongoing problem of the private prison industry, which, of course, is more concerned about the profits for their shareholders than it is about providing a safe environment for the detainees.
Well, it certainly seems that way. And Jason, you're someone who's worked for many years on asylum issues. So what can you tell us about the current outlook for those who come to the U.S. escaping conditions that, in many cases, it seems U.S. foreign policy is responsible for creating?
Well, there's all sorts of issues related to who is coming here because there are different populations. You know, on the one hand, we have this influx of people from Central America who are largely fleeing gang violence and domestic violence. Those aren't necessarily traditional asylum seekers like we think about political refugees or religious refugees, but they are people who face very severe danger. And if you take the time to talk to those people, you'll hear some pretty horrible stories, family members who are murdered, death threats, people who have been raped and sexually abused. So the harm they're suffering is very severe. And the issue for a lot of the Central Americans is that their harm doesn't easily fit within the framework for political asylum. So just because you face harm in your home country doesn't mean you can get asylum in the United States. You have to show that that harm is on account of your race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or particular social group. So those are the five protected categories. And so it's a little bit difficult sometimes to fit these Central American cases into a protected category. And for that reason, there's a pretty high denial rate for cases from Central America and Mexico, even though those people have suffered real harm. I mean, a lot of my clients are people from other countries, like we have journalists from Afghanistan and Pakistan, religious minorities from different countries in Africa. You know, we have LGBT asylum seekers who have many times been harmed in their home country by family members, among others. So the people who are coming here to seek protection are really a wide variety of people from all different countries around the world. The system, unfortunately, is a real disaster, not just at the border, which gets a lot of attention, but there's sort of a hidden asylum crisis, which is there are right now about 600,000 people in the affirmative asylum system. Some of those people have been waiting 5 and 6 years just to get an interview. Some of those people are separated from their family back home. They haven't seen their children in 5 years, 6 years, or more. There's also the immigration court system, which currently has about 1.3 million people waiting for hearings. And those people also, in many cases, have been waiting for years. So what you have is hundreds of thousands of people, many of whom have a real claim to protection under U.S. law and who we are committed to protecting. And I guess one last point I would mention, which you talked about the idea that some of our own policies have caused people to flee their countries. I mean, a very direct example of it are my clients who are working directly with the U.S. government as interpreters, translators, contractors in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, who have, because of their work with the U.S. and their association with the U.S., been threatened and attacked. Those people, you know, clearly have a valid claim for asylum, but there's also people where there's a more indirect problem. For example, Central America, where our policies, especially in the 1980s, encouraged these very right-wing and very brutal dictatorships. The problem of the drug war, with drugs coming up through Central America and weapons coming down from the United States, has created a climate of violence and impunity in many of these countries. And so, you know, I do think from a moral point of view, we have to think about honestly, what do we want to do for these people? Because they're, through no fault of their own in most cases, in a position where they face great harm, and sometimes we do bear some responsibility for putting them in that position.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Jason, for joining us tonight. We want to thank viewers at home for joining us as well. For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
While in Mexico, many of the asylum seekers are targeted by criminal gangs and cartels. Many children are sexually abused or employed for dangerous crime. The dire conditions of the migrants have not become much better today, as they are reportedly allowed to stay in the US. That was our show. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. Please tune in again next week when I come back with another episode of We the People.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Recent studies have shown that wall streets is a primary driver of the climate emergency. The world's 60 largest banks have poured more than $3.8 trillion into the fossil fuel industry since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, says Kenny Stancil, writer, in an article published under the heading "Majority of voters want government to rein in Wall Street's climate destruction," poll shows. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A new poll released recently shows that large majority of voters in the United States want the federal government to bolster its regulation of big banks, insurers, and other financial institutions to prevent climate-driven economic crises. As Common Dreams has reported in the past month, recent studies have shown that Wall Street is a primary driver of the climate emergency. The world's 60 largest banks have poured more than $3.8 trillion into the fossil fuel industry since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015. Furthermore, a substantial percentage of banks' boardrooms have members with deep ties to polluting companies, including many coal, gas, and oil corporations that are primarily responsible for pushing the emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases to record levels by continuing to extract and burn dirty energy sources. Polling conducted in January and March by Data for Progress suggests that many in the U.S. public are keenly aware of this robust connection between financial institutions' investments and environmental destruction, and they want federal regulators, including those at the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and elsewhere, to enact new financial reforms that address climate risks. According to the survey, an overwhelming percentage of voters across age groups, education levels, and geographies support the federal government taking the strong action to rein in Wall Street in order to prevent financiers from laying the groundwork for future climate-driven economic crises by continuing with business as usual. Data for Progress found that overall, three-fifths of voters agreed the federal government should enforce more financial safeguards on big banks and insurers to prevent a future economic crisis driven by climate change. Less than a quarter of voters disagree. Support for climate-related financial regulation was almost identical for voters under 45, that is 61%, and over 45, that is 59%. In addition, a majority of non-college educated, that is 55%, and college-educated, that is 66% voters, and a majority of rural, 61%, suburban, 59%, and urban, 57% voters, all support the federal government enforcing more safeguards on financial institutions to prevent future climate-driven crises. Other key findings from Data for Progress include a majority of voters, that is about 62%, agree the government should enact mandatory climate risk disclosure rules. By a 35 percentage point margin, voters prefer for federal government to enforce climate risk disclosure rules rather than let Wall Street self-regulate their climate risk disclosures. Nearly two-thirds of voters, that is about 63%, agree the Treasury and Federal Reserve should play an active role in protecting the financial system from a future financial crisis driven by climate change. And a majority of voters, that is about 62%, agree that banks making investments in industries that exacerbate climate change should also make investments in frontline communities. Data for Progress also found that drawing a comparison between Wall Street's activities that led to the 2008 recession and their current investments in projects and industries that drive climate change resonates with voters across different age groups, education levels, and geographies. A majority of all voters, that is about 55%, agree that if left unchecked, Wall Street will catalyze another financial crisis, though this time it will be driven by climate change. Younger college-educated and urban voters agree most strongly with that sentiment, but large percentages of voters across those categories concur. The new findings regarding voters' support for curbing the financial industry's exacerbation of the climate emergency through increased federal oversight come as the Biden administration is reportedly finalizing an executive order to develop a strategy on climate-related risks for public and private financial assets. In response to the polling data, members of the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition issued a joint statement. Climate policy has so far been left to markets, and now we are in a climate crisis, said Moira Briss, climate and finance director at Amazon Watch. It's time that the U.S. government take the reins back from the Wall Street so we can assure the rapid, justice-centered decarbonization necessary for a livable planet. Eugenie Shrago, policy counsel at Public Citizen, agreed. Banks, insurers, and asset managers have been gambling with our health and our future for too long, Shrago said. Financial regulators have an obligation to use all of the tools that they already have to immediately start protecting the financial system and frontline communities from Wall Street's contribution to climate chaos, he added.
Midstream.
Israel attacked an Iranian cargo vessel again, this time in the Red Sea as opposed to the one last month in the Mediterranean Sea. According to the New York Times, Israel has already informed the United States that its forces had targeted the Iranian ship Saviz in the Red Sea. In this context, the unnamed American official who spoke to the New York Times said that the Israelis consider this attack as a retaliation for what they call the previous Iranian strikes that had targeted Israeli ships. To add more drama to the matter, the Israelis claimed that there had been a delay in their attack to allow the American aircraft carrier in the region, Dwight D. Eisenhower, to remain at a safe distance from the Iranian ship, which Israel claims is a military one. The damage to the Iranian Saviz vessel came as progress was reported on the first day of talks to revive American participation in the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and major world powers. Israel, which regards Iran as its most potent foe, strongly opposes a restoration of the agreement, which was abandoned by the Trump administration 3 years ago. Commenting on the attack, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh told reporters that the Saviz ship was struck by the blast at around 6 a.m. local time on Tuesday, April 5th, near the coast of Djibouti and sustained minor damage. No fatalities were caused by the incident, and technical evaluations on how the incident occurred and its origins are still underway. The Iranian official emphasized that Tehran will take all the necessary measures regarding the case to international bodies. Rejecting media claims, Khatibzadeh said that Saviz is not a military vessel whose specifications and mission have been formally registered with the International Maritime Organization. In a similar incident last month, an Iranian cargo ship was damaged after it was targeted by a terrorist attack en route to Europe in the Mediterranean Sea. Tehran said back then that such acts of terror are a clear example of naval piracy and run counter to international law and the safety of commercial vessels. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. And an Iranian cargo vessel stationed in the Red Sea was damaged by an Israeli mine attack on Tuesday, April 6th, in an escalation of the shadowy neighbor skirmishing that has characterized Israel's animosity with Iran in recent years. The attack came as Iran and world powers sat down in Vienna for the first talks about the U.S. potentially rejoining Tehran's nuclear deal, showing that challenges ahead do not rest merely in those negotiations. Now, to discuss this issue with us from California is Paul Larudi, former U.S. advisor in the Arabian Peninsula. Thank you very much for being with us, Paul, at such an early hour of the day. I really appreciate it. It seems that the break that Israel had taken during the Trump administration for halting the nuclear deal came to an end when talks now are underway in Vienna for the JCPOA. But now Israel seems more aggressive, pushing for a confrontation at any expense with Iran by targeting the Iranian cargo vessel. How do you think this will play out if Israel continues with this, least to say, reckless behavior?
Well, Israel wants confrontation. It's always shown it. It's part of its history. And it's doing it again. The result of this will be that Iran will retaliate. And it has shown that it will retaliate, for example, with the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and the attack on the Ain al-Assad American base in, mm-hmm. inside Iraq. And so this is likely to be the what will happen. Of course, Iran will do so proportionally. They have, that's what they did in the case of the assassination, and that's what they will do again. And it's also the way Hezbollah functions. So there will be retaliation.
Well, Israel, which regards Iran as its most maybe potent foe in the region, strongly opposes a restoration of any nuclear agreement with Iran. And the latest that we saw is the attack on Natanz power plant as well. What does that have to do with Israel to begin with? I mean, how would an international agreement threaten Israel in any way?
Well, from Iran's, from Israel's point of view, the problem with the agreement is that it lifts the sanctions, and Israel wants the sanctions to continue. It wants to harm Iran as much as possible. Iran is standing in the way of Israeli expansion and weakening Israel's neighbors. Because a powerful nation like Iran can come to the aid of Israel's neighbors. So this is part of the Israeli general strategy of weakening its neighbors, and mm-hmm. it wants as much confrontation to exist, whether from Israel directly or from the United States and other countries, to weaken Iran. So that's its objective.
But we did hear Tehran in the last time that there was such an attack on an Iranian vessel. It happened last month in March and on the Mediterranean Sea while the vessel was en route to Europe. But Tehran said at that time that such acts of terror are a clear example of naval piracy and run counter to all international law on the safety of commercial vessels, reiterating that it will retaliate to these acts of aggression. What are the Iranian options here? Will it just become an eye for an eye in the open sea?
Well, I think ultimately there may be some of that, an eye for an eye. And Israel has shown that it cares nothing for international law. It will behave the way it wants to. It needs some action, some retaliation, and some disciplining, as, for example, Hezbollah has shown. I mean, Hezbollah has been attacked, its members have been killed, and it has retaliated, and proportionally. And the result is that Israel becomes quiet because they know that Hezbollah has the power to do that. Well, it's the same thing with Iran. Israel has to learn that Iran's not going to take it and that the only discipline that they're going to get is an Iranian retaliation. So there may be a tit for tat, an eye for an eye, for some time. But I think ultimately Israel will see that this is useless and that it harms Israel more than it harms Iran.
Well, it seems that several regional files are being put on hold waiting for the breakthrough talks of the JCPOA and the return of possible diplomatic relations between Iran and the U.S., basically from Yemen to Lebanon to Syria and Iraq, and now the Israeli-Iranian feud. Are we exaggerating if we say the entire West of Asia is right now at a crossroad?
If it's not right now at a crossroads, it soon will be with things going the way they are. In fact, the sanctioned nations are becoming a kind of common market of sanctioned nations. They are helping each other. They are finding allies. Iran just signed a 25-year economic agreement, $400 billion with China, and and Russia also is participating in this kind of sanctions common market. Even the European nations kind of found another way to get past the sanctions for certain purposes. So things are changing. The power of the United States is extending its power beyond its means, and the result will be that the other nations will get together and find ways around it and to develop their own power base. They need to do that because the main threat is the United States.
Well, wouldn't that bear the question of when that happens, wouldn't the United States go all out for a war to try and retake the position that it had lost?
It's always possible, but I don't think the United we can hope that the United States population will resist that, because the U.S. population is being impoverished and is without resources. More people are on the street. The homeless population is growing by leaps and bounds. And to have this greater burden than they have now, when half of their entire national budget is going for defense, more than half, in fact, I think the United States is reaching the limits of its capabilities, and we're watching a superpower decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely is something to look out for in West Asia, especially when Israel has been very blatant about its attack on whether the Islamic Republic of Iran or other allies of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the region, namely in Syria, Iraq, and in South Lebanon. I want to thank you very much from California, Mr. Paul LaRudy, former U.S. advisor in the Arabian Peninsula, for joining us to talk about this shadowy naval war that's going on in our region. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking how Hezbollah is implementing the economic resistance in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
For over a year, there has been a severe economic and political crisis in Lebanon, whose end is not in sight. In view of this, the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah has made a series of moves aimed at helping any needy Lebanese population cope with the negative implications of the economic crisis. With shortages of goods and skyrocketing prices, Hezbollah has opened a chain of supermarkets selling inexpensive goods at subsidized prices that are about 30 to 50% lower than the market price. Hezbollah's response to the economic crisis in Lebanon in this following report.
Since October 2019, there has been a severe financial, economic, and political crisis in Lebanon, whose end is not in sight. Underlying the crisis are fundamental problems, mainly firmly rooted corruption and a chronic state of political instability. Additional difficulties have been added to the fundamental problems. The COVID-19 crisis, the negative effects of U.S. sanctions on the Lebanese economy and banking system, the explosion of the port of Beirut, difficulties stemming from the global war on Syria, and the lack of external assistance due to Lebanon's failure to carry out the reforms required by the international community. These effects were reflected in a shortage of basic essential products like food, fuel, and medication, difficulties in the banking system, and even initial signs of weakened security. In view of this, Hezbollah has made a series of moves aimed at helping the Lebanese population cope with the negative implications of the economic crisis. As the Lebanese market suffers from shortages of goods and skyrocketing prices, Hezbollah has opened a chain of supermarkets called Al-Nur Depot in southern Lebanon, South Beirut, and the Baqaa Valley. These supermarkets sell inexpensive goods at subsidized prices that are about 30 to 50% lower than the market prices. Payment is made through a special shopper's card called the Al-Sajjad card, named after the fourth Shia imam who attached great importance to mutual solidarity in society. A drug shortage in Lebanon also prompted Hezbollah to begin purchasing Syrian and Iranian inexpensive drugs and medical products. The medical products were distributed to Hezbollah's affiliated pharmacies to cover the shortage. A fuel shortage that has led to rising prices of fuel products and frequent power outages also prompted Hezbollah to purchase fuel products and supply fuel to gas stations in the resistance areas where the U.S. undeclared sanctions are leading to critical fuel shortages in gas stations. To help the Lebanese people overcome the severe economic crisis accompanied by currency collapse and insane increase in prices, Hezbollah has become the last resort for the Lebanese public to survive the worst economic crisis in the country's modern history.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament for the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, following the difficulties caused by the economic crisis in Lebanon, Hezbollah's response was direct aid of its community by opening a chain of supermarkets in South Lebanon, in South Beirut, and in the Baqaa Valley. These supermarkets are selling inexpensive goods at subsidized prices, despite the fact that they are not subsidized goods, but with prices lower than 50% of the market price. Why on earth would that call for any scrutiny or even frustration from anyone?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss this. First of all, you're talking about a highly divided Lebanese society. You're talking about a kind of polarization between East and West, if you want to say, between people who follow the Western hegemonic powers, namely the USA and other powers who support the tightening of the Western grip over the country and over the region and over the area, as we all know, and between others who are the supporters of their own country, their domestic genuine interest of the people and the land, the liberators of the land, those who are deeply entrenched in their lands. This kind of division is going to be translated into positions of frustration from one area and from one crowd, from one audience. And on the other hand, it's a sigh of relief, it's a hilarious and happiness for the faithfulness, for the loyalty, for the attention, for the care from Hezbollah, from the resistance to the Lebanese people. I say the Lebanese people, yes, because the Shia areas that you mentioned, they represent the part of the Lebanese society. If we have the capability, we are starting to support in the most striking areas, in the areas that are under the highest tightened pressure from the United States of America. And we all know that, and all the Lebanese know that. If our capabilities are enough, we are going to extend this to whoever would accept it or would want it, because, as I told you, this has been a source of criticism from other sides. We don't care about it. We are talking about people who have served their lives, who have sacrificed their blood, who have given everything to this true path of resistance and nationalism.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, the thing that actually brought about a certain kind of frustration, which I found odd, but we need to explain to the audience, which is the payments for these goods in the Hezbollah supermarkets, they are being made through a special shopper's card called a Sajjad card. It's the name of the fourth Shia Imam, Zain al-Abidin, the son of Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, who attached great importance to mutual solidarity in society. That was his legacy. Does that suggest purpose that this card is strictly for the Shia of Lebanon?
Absolutely not. I did tell you this because when we talk about the universality of the message of Islam, it's for everybody, anywhere, anyone who is in need. When we talk about Imam Sajjad, Imam Zain al-Abidin, salamullah alayhi, we're talking about a source of mercy, a source of kindness and grace for all. And here we are talking especially on the eve of Shahr Ramadan. May all of the prayers of Allah be upon all the believers and all the people. This is the month of mercy. We wanted to emulate this great Imam who used to have the goods of the people, of the poor, of the orphans, of the needy. He used to go from one place to another carrying this over his back and not showing himself during the nights and during the days. He was like going there and they didn't know about him. It was until he died that the people knew that he was the one who was sending the message. Of course, at the time, the society was not that complicated. The houses were very few. If we talk about 100 years ago or 200 years ago in the villages, everybody would know everybody. What about if you're talking about 1,300 or 1,200 years ago? So this is the message that we wanted to send. It's not limited. It's not restricted to these areas, but it is the beginning, and hopefully we would be able to extend this to all, to everyone who is in need.
Well, a fuel shortage that has led to rising prices of the fuel products and frequent power outages due to the bankruptcy of the Lebanese Central Bank, which is a result of decades of corruption in Lebanon, Hezbollah has begun, the party has begun purchasing fuel products, especially diesel fuel, and supplying fuel gas to fuel oil to gas stations that are not receiving any fuel from the government, especially in stations that happen to be in areas that support Hezbollah, which is basically undeclared U.S. sanctions against an entire population. This is basically collective punishment. But if the central bank is bankrupt, how come only the Shia communities are suffering from this fuel shortage?
Well, actually, it's not only the fuel shortages in the Shia area. To tell you the truth, there are restrictions on the borders here and there. And there is another point that I want. Unfortunately, when we talk about the merchants, the big merchants, those who have the ability to make any kind of restriction over the fuel oil, over these goods, they want to keep them. So when the prices go up, they make use of it. This is a big problem, actually. But to tell you the truth, the Iranian side, the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon has made it very clear to the Lebanese government, everyone, that Iran is ready to hand out the help for the Lebanese community and for the Lebanese government, for the Lebanese state, to take the fuel from Iran, and they would use the Lebanese lira, the Lebanese pound. This is an unprecedented, and this would help in easing, and if you want, and solving the problem of the fuel, and this would like save a very important and dear money for the government. The government refused. They don't want to take this position. The same offer has been given about the electricity, that Iran is ready to build fields and plants of electricity, so it could be locally and domestically here in Lebanon generated, not to take from any side. Mm-hmm. Again, it was refused. So it is the general help for all of the Lebanese people. Some accepted, others refused. This is the problem. Again, those who refused, some of them because they hate the axis of resistance, because they follow another completely different axis. Mm-hmm. And another era or another another area, other people, they are afraid of more restrictions and more sanctions from the American side. We, in this axis of resistance, we are going to do everything possible to help the Lebanese generally and our people particularly to ease the situation over them, whether it is for fuel or whatever.
Unfortunately,
please.
That's all the time that we have. We have one more minute, Dr. Moussaoui, but I want to talk about expanding the services of Al-Qard Al-Hassan Association just after the financial collapse in Lebanon. I know that these plans are Hezbollah's ways of dealing with the economic downfall, but now they have their own chain of banks as well, and also ATM machines. But doesn't that just fall in the validation of the notion of a state within a state?
Absolutely not. I categorically deny and refuse this. To tell you the truth, the government is there and we want them. This is something. When you talk, you're not talking about chain of banks or branches of banks. You're talking about ATMs. It is only restricted to this charity groups called Qard al-Hassan. It has been there. Qard al-Hassan has been there as an institution since more than 30 years. But yes, truly, it has been expanded after the sanctions that has taken place because people want to put their money in a safe place that they can take it anytime they want, and they are not taking any kind of interests for having it there. This is something that has been, you know, when you put people at risk and they make it an opportunity, this is the menace that has been changed into an opportunity by Hezbollah, by the axis of the resistance, by the people who trust the resistance. Mm-hmm. This has pushed many people, because they talked about Qard al-Hassan, many people felt that it is their duty to go and put their money there, because mm-hmm. it is safer than the
central bank. So it's basically a matter of trust between the Lebanese people and the resistance. I want to thank you very much.
If you ask all of the experts, they tell you the number one issue in Lebanon is the trust.
Exactly. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, for the loyalty to the resistance bloc, Hezbollah, for being with us to talk about this very important issue, how Hezbollah is leading an economy of resistance in Lebanon. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Injections of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose coronavirus vaccine came to a sudden halt in much of the U.S. on Tuesday, April 13th, after federal health agencies called for a pause in the vaccine's use following emergence of a rare blood clotting disorder in 6 recipients. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Quayle, writer. This article is published under the heading Out of Abundance of Caution, FDA and CDC Recommend